Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. Today I'd like to welcome to the program Stacy Pershall. She's written a book called Loud in the House of Myself, Memoir of a Strange Girl. She joins us by telephone from, where are you?
I'm in New York City.
All right. Well, can we expect to hear ambulances then? And
you may actually hear the subway rumbling overhead. I live right underneath the elevated subway in Astoria, Queens.
Oh, can't wait.
Yeah, so if you hear the subway rumbling by in the background, then that's exactly what it is. It just goes overhead once you get out of Manhattan.
We love a little ambient sound.
Right.
So
well, you'll have some.
It'll even be louder in the house
right, exactly.
of yourself.
Louder in the house of Stacy.
So you've had an interesting life so far.
I think so. I'm turning 40 in a couple of months, and I think I'm doing okay. I'm ready to go into my 40s.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm ready to slide on in there, I think.
Well, I finished the book last week, and I thought, wow, if she didn't grow up in this little town in Arkansas, would she have turned out differently? What do you think?
Right. Well, I mean, I write about that in the book. I think it's in the last chapter about how, would I have developed borderline personality disorder without the invalidating environment, which is what they call it these days. And in dialectical behavioral therapy, which is the therapy that I talk about in the book that helped me so much, that's one of the buzzwords that you hear a lot is invalidating environment. You take a kid who has a genetic predisposition toward mental illness, and you put that child in an environment in which they are frequently told that they are other, and then you see what happens. And I think the sort of current idea about where borderline personality disorder comes from is that it's a combination of a genetic predisposition to mental illness and this invalidating environment of childhood. So, I mean, that's the big question.
Would it be correct to say that you were born in the Bible Belt?
Yes, absolutely correct.
You talk about your little town in your memoir, and it sounds like a lot of little towns out there in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it is. It's being subsumed by strip malls like everywhere else. You know, it looks like that's one of the things that makes me really sad. I went back to my hometown over the summer last year, and all the old Victorian houses are being knocked down and apartment complexes are being built or subdivisions with houses that all look the same and blocks of these brown brick houses and so many strip malls that you get lost in them and you're like, wait a minute, is this the strip mall with the Target or the strip mall with the Walmart? And it's starting to look like everywhere else, and it makes me kind of sad, actually.
You talk in the book extensively about some problems that you had with eating disorders. And I don't think I've ever read descriptions that really let me understand what was happening with this kind of situation.
And this one did?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm very glad to hear that. Have you read Wasted by Mario Hornbacher?
No.
That's a really good book for understanding the mindset of eating disorders, of anorexia and bulimia. And Mario was actually really instrumental in helping this book get written. She was my champion from the beginning and has become a really good friend. So I highly recommend her book, Wasted, and the follow-up book, Madness, which just came out a couple of years ago.
You also grew up in a situation where, because of the deeply religious community that you were living in, you felt like you really had to be a part of that, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's the same way that I felt like I had to be a cheerleader, to have friends. There are not a wide range of identities to choose from there, so I did my best, which was obviously a dismal failure at fitting into the sort of predominant one.
And then you discovered there was a world outside of your little town, and you started to have your doubts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I started to have my doubts when I saw Andy Warhol on the Love Boat. And I actually, I think I write about that in the book. You know, it's sometimes it's hard to remember. I've been reading little sections of it, again, because I've been doing readings since it came out. But my editor took an 85,000 word manuscript and cut it down to 65,000 words. So sometimes I'll start talking about something that I think is in the book and then realize that it actually didn't make it into the book. But yeah, I think the Andy Warhol on the Love Boat thing did, and I remember someone saying, you know, that he was an artist from New York City, and he had this two-tone, like, silver and black hair and these big red glasses, and he walked around with this Polaroid camera, and I just thought that was the coolest thing anybody could possibly be, is an artist from New York City.
So do you think if you'd grown up in Astoria, Queens, that you would have turned out differently, like so-called normally?
I don't know about normal. I mean, I think normal is kind of inborn when it comes right down to it. You know, you either have the propensity for curiosity and wonder and a sense of dissatisfaction that leads you to seek out others like yourself, or you don't. You know, you either fit in or you don't. And, yeah, I think that there would have been more options for who to be if I had grown up in New York City. But whether or not I would have still felt like an outsider, you know, I mean, I know plenty of people who did grow up here who did feel like outsiders. And, you know, I don't know. It's just the eternal question. It's just the chicken and egg question.
Yeah. So how far are you from the Mets ballpark?
You know, I know absolutely nothing about sports, and I know that the Yankees play in one place and the Mets play in another.
Uh-huh. I figure you're probably close if you're in Astoria.
Yeah, I mean, like, they're in Queens. I think they're both in Queens, right?
Yeah, well,
don't play this part.
the Yankees are in the Bronx, actually. But you're...
Oh, okay, well, see, there you go. I've lived here for 12 years, and I'm like, I think they're both in Queens. Both the airports are in Queens.
I hear you. My guest is Stacy Pershall. Her book is Memoir of a Strange Girl, Loud in the House of Myself. It was recently published by Norton. You've come a long way. What kind of a day are you having today?
You know what I've been doing today is I knit and crochet a lot. And I have a friend who has cancer right now, and I'm making her a couple of chemo hats that I want to get to her before she goes into the hospital for the next round of chemo. So that's what I'm doing today, making hats.
And you're also a tattoo collector.
I am.
How's the collection coming along?
Oh, it's never fast enough, you know. It's like people always ask me, what are you going to do when you don't have any skin left to cover? And I'm like, rejoice. Are you kidding? Like, you know, it's painful and I'm old and I'm just like ready for it to be done. But there's still a bit of blank space left.
Do you want to talk about the anorexia and the bulimia?
If you want to.
Well, I think our listeners are probably wondering about it because this is a big issue in our society today.
Right.
There's a lot of it that goes on. And frankly, we have trends in fashion, I think, that kind of make us overlook it.
Right, right. Like the model that just died in France. Do you know about her, Isabelle Caro, C-A-R-O? I don't know if I'm saying that right.
There was a Brazilian before that.
Right. And I can't remember her name. Anna something? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't remember. But Isabelle Caro just died, and she was a French model who, her weight got down to, you know, I don't know, something like 60 pounds or 70 pounds, you know, something really terrible and frightening and on the verge of death. And she did an ad campaign where she did billboards in France naked and, you know, like strategically covered, but naked. And, you know, it was just basically a warning, like putting the image of anorexia on billboards for everyone to see and saying, this is what an anorexic woman's body looks like. It's not pretty. It's not what you might be thinking when you think, oh, I just want to be thin. And she's been in the media there, and there are videos of her on YouTube, you know, talking about this and interviews with her. And she's been doing this campaign for a couple of years, but she passed away recently. And in the wake of her death, her mother committed suicide.
Oh, my.
So this has just happened. And she was, you know, a young woman. I think she was still in her 20s. And so, you know, anorexia took two lives.
When you describe the purging that you went through, this just really got me. I had no idea of the kind of things that someone could go through. And the one that really got me was you were working at, was like a roller skating rink?
Yeah, right. The skate place.
And you'd go in there and you would consume massive quantities of food, but then you would just immediately get rid of it all.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
That's just amazing to read about. I mean, it never really hit me until I read something like that, just how severe this was.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's really, you become like a bottomless pit. You lose all sense of when you're hungry and when you're not hungry and when you're full and when you're not full and when eating is healthy and when it's unhealthy. And you just become like one big alimentary canal. You exist to take in and spit out food. And it becomes your whole life. And it becomes a challenge. How much can I eat and not gain weight? You know, as you can see from the book, it's a lot. You can eat a lot and not gain weight. But the price is very high.
This early boyfriend of yours in high school, he really kind of pushed you over the line, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those turning points in the illness when I don't want to ever say it was anybody else's fault. Anybody else was responsible for my developing an eating disorder. But if I was going to say that one person was, my high school boyfriend might be the person that I would pin it on. And obviously I take complete responsibility for it myself. And it was my choice and it was my decision and it was my behavior. But that behavior started when I met him.
Stacy Pershall joins us. Her book is Loud in the House of Myself, Memoir of a Strange Girl. You finally got out of that town, but things didn't necessarily improve, did they?
Right. Exactly. They didn't improve much at all. They improved in the sense that I was in a bigger place where there were more books. And that's a big improvement, you know, when you've grown up your whole life just aching for this education that you're not getting, and suddenly you're in a place where there's more than one independent bookstore, you know, or just, I mean, I grew up, there was no Barnes & Noble where I grew up. There was no Borders. There was no big chain store. And when I went to a place where those existed, where there was not only Barnes & Noble, but there were independent bookstores scattered all over the city, it was like coming to life. And so in one sense, things changed very much. But then in another sense, the sense that I was still empty, they didn't change at all. I just took my emptiness with me to another place.
And you traveled? You went to London?
I did. I traveled a lot in my life, actually. It's one of my, I just got back from spending 6 months in Oaxaca, Mexico, and it's one of the things that I'm so happy in my adult life that I have a chance to do.
That's a very exotic place. I've never been there, but I've seen pictures.
It's a crazy place. They have a lot of crazy holidays there. Like they have Night of the Radishes, where they carve radishes, Noche de los Rábanos, and they carve radishes into figurines. They have, like, in the main square of the city, they have all these little radish sculptures.
I love it.
And it's the Night of the Radishes, and it's one of the ways they celebrate Christmas.
You were fortunate enough to encounter people throughout your life that kind of gave you anchors to hold on to.
Right.
And one guy in particular was this, what would you call him, a counselor?
Phil Thornton, my therapist. He was a clinical psychologist and my therapist when I was in high school and part of college.
And he's someone that kind of recognized that there was something that needed to be addressed, and he gave you some advice that really helped you.
He did. Harm's way. I now have this tattooed on me. Across the back of my neck, it says Harm's way. And the advice he gave me is the advice that I have given to so many young people since then, which is your job is to put yourself in harm's way. Your job is to try and fail. And the trying is more important than the failing.
Did putting yourself in harm's way also make you suicidal?
I think I was suicidal. I think there has been an inkling of suicidality in me for about as long as I've been conscious, honestly. I remember being a little kid, being about 5 years old, and not being able to figure out the concept of forever, and thinking that the people who said that after you died, you would live forever if you went to heaven, must be wrong, because how could there possibly be any such thing as time that didn't eventually stop? it terrified me, and I didn't want anything to do with it, you know? I wanted to think that there would be a time when it stopped. There would be a time when it was over. And, you know, I remember wishing this at 5 years old. So I do think that there, in the sense that as I got older and continued to put myself in harm's way, I chose some not-so-intelligent ways to do it. And it was more about the harm than anything, more about the harm than anything good that could possibly come of it. And I put myself in circumstances that led to suicide attempts.
Was that the train that just went by?
That was the train. Did you hear it?
I heard it.
That's it.
I could tell. I could feel the earth moving.
All the way in Ohio, the earth moved.
Stacy Pershall joins us. Her book is Loud in the House of Myself, A Memoir of a Strange Girl. And you embraced technology early on, and in a way that kind of saved your life back in 1999, didn't it?
Saved my life or led to an attempt to end it.
Which came first?
I feel like that's what I keep answering to all your questions, is which came first, which was it first.
Well, this incident in the entire book, this is the one that really stood out to me as just an incredible thing, because you had installed these webcams in your house and you were literally on the internet all the time.
Right.
And then you were really down, and you decided to end it all, and someone saw you.
Yeah, that was one of the not-so-smart decisions that I've made in my life. And it happened 10 years ago this year, and I kind of feel like I've finally come full circle. Like, publishing this book was a way of wrapping up that decade, and now I'm just really ready to have some peace and quiet and be sane, you know, now that I have the tools to do that. But in a lot of ways, I'm still living down 2001. Whenever people see that you are in distress, there will always be people who will use that as an opportunity to kick you when you're down, to hurt you more. And that happened, you know, within hours of the suicide attempt, there were parody sites, you know, and it's incredibly hurtful. I mean, it's devastating, but it's over. And I'm alive now a decade later, and really happy to be here.
And here you have this book, and it's all coming to the surface again. And people like me who didn't know anything about any of this stuff, here I am going, gee, Stacy, you want to talk about
talk about suicide? Yeah, you know, and I wouldn't have published this book if I weren't totally okay with talking about it. You know, I mean, it was a long time ago now, and
yeah.
There's been a lot of therapy and a lot of work in between then and now. So I'm fine with talking about it.
What is borderline personality disorder? I had never heard of it.
Really? Borderline personality disorder is kind of a, I don't want to say a hot diagnosis, because then that makes it sound like it's ADD, you know, like it's every kid who can't pay attention or every girl who, you know, listens to morbid music and dresses in black, you know, has this disorder. But there's actually a movement to rename it emotion dysregulation disorder, which I think is a much more explanatory, a much more explanatory description, does a much better job of explaining what it is. It's a disorder of being unable to control your emotions or to respond to emotional stimulus at a normal level. Something that might vaguely irritate somebody can send somebody who's borderline into a violent rage. And later, of course, then there are these feelings of self-reproach, of self-hatred, of tremendous shame and guilt. And those feelings of shame and guilt are intrinsic to the disorder as well, and keep people from getting well sometimes, because they don't feel that they deserve to. Not feeling that you deserve to be treated like a human being is a big component of this illness.
So it's not uncommon.
It's not uncommon. I feel like I should be able to give you exact statistics. I want to say it's something like 7% of the United States population, but don't use that, because I'm not sure.
Yeah. And what is dialectical behavioral therapy?
DBT is based on cognitive behavioral therapy, but with a healthy dose of Eastern mysticism, of Zen Buddhism. And it's a four-module therapy, and you spend 6 months to a year and a half, which is how long I was in DBT, a year and a half, going through these four modules, which are mindfulness, which basically is exactly what it sounds like and uses meditation techniques derived from Buddhism, distress tolerance, which teaches you how to get through the moment without making it worse, interpersonal effectiveness, which teaches you much-needed relationship skills, how to deal with other human beings without it becoming pathological, without becoming so entrenched in them that you lose yourself, and emotion regulation is the fourth one. Yeah, so those are the four modules of DBT.
Stacy Pershall joins us. She's written a book, her memoir, of a strange girl. It's called Loud in the House of Myself. I don't think you're that strange myself, but
thank you.
I mean, you're telling your story here, and you make the point near the end of the book, and it's a point that I agree with 1,000,000%, and that is that telling stories is our only power.
It's true. It's like my hero Richard Powers says. Do you know Richard Powers?
I don't know him.
No, he is. He's my favorite living writer, and he wrote this brilliant book called Galatea 2.2, and I just had the first of these two sentences tattooed on my leg, and on my other leg I'm having the other sentence, but it's, you make what you think might be a vase for the blooms you are carrying. You tell the stories you need to tell to keep the stories tellable, and I think that's what being a writer is. I think that's what being a human is.
Now, when you tattoo that on yourself, is that like a form of a crib note? I'm just kidding.
You know, I have one of those. I have a crib note tattoo, which is, this is going to sound so ridiculous and sound like such an eye roller, like talk about not being strange, but I have a Yoga Sutra tattooed around my neck, and in Sanskrit, but it translates to, when disturbed by disturbing thoughts, think of the opposite.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah, which is a good thing. So, yeah. You know, it's kind of my never forget how lucky you are tattoo.
Yeah. Well, we have a culture that is heavily reliant on various medications to treat all the different kinds of psychological and mental situations that we face. And you have had tremendous experience with some of these pharmaceutical products. How many? 24 different ones?
24, and I think it's up to 20. I guess it's up to 25 now because my shrink actually just prescribed a new one the other day.
So yeah. You're kind of an authority on them, aren't you? But isn't everybody different? Doesn't everyone react differently to these medications?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, all the drugs have side effects in common. There are side effects that are typical of these medications. For example, mood stabilizers like Depakote and lithium tend to cause tremendous weight gain. Some of the antipsychotics, the newer ones like Zyprexa and Seroquel, also feature weight gain as an unfortunate side effect, but a very common one.
And at the end of the commercials on TV, you point out they always bring in Alvin and the Chipmunks to do the record. This will make you get really, really fat and blah, blah, blah at the very end.
Right, exactly. Exactly. May cause heart attack and stroke. And, you know, then they list like 15 different things, but it'll make you smile.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Well, you're making me smile just hearing about all this. And I'm very pleased that you wrote this book. I think this book is something that will be an eye-opener for a lot of people.
Thank you. I hope so. I mean, it's all for the strange girls. Like, if nobody else responded to it, and of course there are, you know, there are always going to be people who, anybody can have an opinion on a blog, right? But there are always going to be people, and there are people who are responding to this book in this way by saying, oh, you know, it's one more book by one more depressed chick about her problems. And I like to think that it's not, you know, I like to think that it's more than just that it's more than I'm so depressed and here's everything, you know, that's wrong and everybody that done me wrong. And I like to think that, you know, maybe this is a book that some kid who's 16 years old in Arkansas or, you know, small town Ohio, wherever, will find and say, oh my God, there's somebody else out there that went through this. There's another girl. There's somebody else. And you know, you always hear people say, and if one person gets it, you know, but it's really kind of true. Like, if one girl finds this and decides that maybe she'd rather live than die, then it's worth it.
Some kid that just went by on that train in Astoria, Queens.
Right, the train. Yeah, well, they're like every 5 minutes.
I think it's a courageous book. Have you done many interviews about it?
Just a few. I mean, it's only a week old. It's a week old today.
Well, we like them fresh on this program. Yeah.
I mean, it's 9 years old for me, but it's a week old for the world.
We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Stacy Pershall. Her book is Loud in the House of Myself, Memoir of a Strange Girl. And she may feel like she's a strange girl, but she's just like you and me. You're just a human being.
Right.
Aren't
like you and me, but more colorful. Yeah.
Well, good luck with the book, and thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1994, when I started interviewing authors in the Book Nook, I never imagined that I would get to the point where I started taking the long view of the work that many authors have accomplished over the years. And about 10 years ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing an author who had written her first collection of short stories. Lucrezia Guerrero published a book called Chasing Shadows, and I absolutely loved it. And over the 10 years since, I've stayed in touch with her, and I've had a chance to read some of her work that she was trying to get done. And I knew she was working on a novel. And finally, after all this time, her novel has been published, and I read it, and I was delighted. And we're going to have Lucrezia Guerrero come back on the program next week to tell us about her debut novel, all these years in the making. It's called Tree of Sighs. That's Lucrezia Guerrero in the Book Nook, right here on WYSO, where we take the long view. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.